The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Revolt, is the first of a 12-part series, From the Fall of Betar to the Completion of the Mishnah. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos Moshe Aaron ben Zvi Chaim, V'Rivka Rachel bas Yehoshua Yehuda, Aleichem HaShalom, Mr. and Mrs. Moshe and Rivka Kirstein of blessed memory.
If there's one word that captures the hope and vision of Jewry throughout the thousands of years of our persecution and exile, one word that symbolizes the indomitable spirit of the Jewish people throughout the ages, that word is Moshiach. The word Moshiach conjures up diverse and often conflicting images. There's the image of a warrior leading the fight for independence against formidable and implacable foes. There's the image of a gentle scholar guiding us in a new age of understanding and boundless knowledge. And, of course, there's the image of the King of Israel and all of humanity, ushering in an age of peace and unprecedented prosperity. When will Mashiach finally reveal himself? How will we know for sure when he comes? After all, throughout the ages, people have arisen, claiming to be the rightful heir to the throne of David HaMelech, King David, and the title of Mashiach, only to leave disillusion and sorrow in their wake. In our previous lectures, we've touched upon some of these self-styled Mashiachs, Yeshu HaNotzri, as well as several of the self-proclaimed saviors mentioned by Josephus. But these so-called Moshiachs attracted an ignorant and gullible fringe element of the population. The Pharisees, the rabbinic leadership of Israel, never accepted them, were openly opposed to these exercises in futility. But there was one exception, however. One time in history, a leader arose who convinced some of the best and brightest scholars in Jewry that he was truly Mashiach. He was a warrior who for a time successfully freed Israel from Roman domination and kindled the hopes and dreams of millions of Jews. That man's name, Bar Kochva. His story is the subject of tonight's lecture. But before we begin, it's important to put this story in its true historical perspective and try to understand how previous events shaped and formed the setting of the Bar Kochva rebellion. The story of Bar Kochva really begins at the twilight of the Second Temple. As we studied at length in previous lectures, towards the end of the Second Temple, there was a rash of violent anti-Semitic incidents. Whole Jewish communities were slaughtered out by their Greek-speaking neighbors. In the year 37 of the Common Era, the Jewish community of Alexandria, one of the largest Jewish communities in the world, was subject to pogroms and ghettoization that rivaled the worst terrors of pre-World War II Europe. 29 years later, in the year 66 of the Common Era, the Roman army, under the leadership of the apostate Jew Alexander Tiberius, killed out at least 50,000 Jews in Alexandria, men, women, and children, besides the untold number that were killed by the local populace. As Josephus so aptly put it in the sixth section of his autobiography, in his account of the Jewish uprising and the subsequent destruction of the temple, I quote, "I would demonstrate to my readers that the Jews' war with the Romans was not voluntary, but that for the main they were forced by necessity to enter into it," end quote. In fact, it seems that the hatred of the non-Jewish populace towards the Jews was so great that only the fear of the might of the Roman legions was able to deter them from even greater bloodshed and pillage. The Roman legions defended the Jews, however, only when it served their own self-interest. That is why it was always necessary to bribe Roman generals and officials in order to ensure the Jews had equal protection under the law and that justice be served. Just as an aside, the historian Rav Isaac Halevi offered a compelling explanation as to why there was such a breakdown of law and order the time right before the destruction of the temple. One of the greatest resources of wealth that the Jewish people possessed was the Oitzer HaMikdash, monies that were collected from Jews throughout the world and sent to the temple. That money was used not only for the sacrifices and the upkeep of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, but also for communal needs as well. If the need was there, according to Rav Isaac Halevi, the Sanhedrin had the right to use the money to bribe Roman officials to ensure the safety of the Jewish community. Towards the end of the temple, the control of the temple funds was taken from the Sanhedrin and put into the hands of Agrippa, the Hellenized descendant of Herod, who used the money for his own ends and the ends of his corrupt cronies. Without use of the resource of the temple to bribe Roman officials, the Jews were at a distinct disadvantage. Hence, the reluctance of the Romans, who disliked the Jews in any case, to protect them or to hold themselves back from perpetrating slaughter and pillage together with their enemies. From the destruction of the temple in the year 70 until the year 116, for almost 50 years, there was relative calm. But in that year, towards the end of the reign of the Emperor Trajan, the full fury of anti-Semitism was unleashed with horrifying results. Probably the greatest tragedy of that period, towards the end of the year of the reign of Trajan, was the destruction of Alexandrian Jewry. This is taken from the Medrash Tandavei Eliyahu. Trajan came and conquered Alexandria. They had a population of 1,200,000. He deceived them by telling them, go out and stand in Bikas Yadayim, Bikas, a field or a valley, so that this nation, the Egyptian Greeks, should not dominate you. Evidently, what they're saying here is that the Jews were having terrible problems with the local populace. And as we've stated before, and we're going to see further on, there's tremendous animosity between the Greek-speaking neighbors, those of the Jews, and the Jews, to the extent that the Jews were encouraged to take up arms and defend themselves out in the battlefield. And this was done at the suggestion of the Romans. They went out and stood in Bikas Yadayim, and they, the Romans, placed 50,000 troops with swords in their hands behind them and slaughtered them so that not one of them was left. So here we have, and we're going to see it a little clearer, we have the involvement. The Jews went out to fight with the Egyptian Greeks, and yet it seems the Romans were the ones who killed the Jews, not the Egyptian Greeks. And again, it goes on to describe in great detail about that the blood was so intense that that they used it to fertilize their vineyards for 7 years. This is in the year 116. 117, 116. In other words, the Jews were lured outside of Alexandria in order to fight their neighbors. It's not clear from these sea sources what role the neighbors had, in other words, what the locals had. But it was a setup, because they had originally did this in order to set up the Jews and in order to kill them. After they had killed the men on the battlefield, they went back to the homes and killed out the rest of the populace. This is what we have from this And again, we have a pop. We have a that well over a million people were killed, and all in a relatively short period of time. That's the Jewish version. We are now going to hear the non-Jewish version. It's just important to realize when we are listening to the non-Jewish version of what would be blatant anti-Semitic outbursts, one would have to, if God forbid, the Nazis had been victorious, and they would be writing a history of what had transpired during World War II, and they were writing about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, it would be much different than the history we read today. But we have other sources dealing with this incident of the destruction of Alexandrian Jewry. One is a note that we're going to see. We quote this a little further on the bottom of page 5. We just notice here on section 2 at the bottom of page 5a, in the year 118, this is when Hadrian assumed now the, this is a year afterwards, this is assumed the throne. Hadrian rebuilds Alexandria at public expense. Notice he forced the Greeks to rebuild Alexandria, yet having suffered damage from the Jews. It doesn't really read well. If the Jews are at fault, what is he taxing the non-Jews who are victims to rebuild? It would seem that really what's happened, this is Eusebius who's writing this, who was no great lover of Jews. Of course, they blamed everything on the Jews. But what Hadrian had done, it seems, is that he had ascertained that the fault was with the non-Jews who destroyed all of this, and fine them to really build a considerable part of Alexandria at their expense. Rav Isaac Halevi also quotes from the German historian Scherer, who quotes two fragments of a papyrus, one in the Louvre, one in the French Museum, and one in the British Museum. They're only fragments of a papyrus, but they deal with this incident. And it seems, and this is how Scherer reads these fragments and puts them together. After the emperor came to the throne, as would seem Hadrian, a delegation of Jews, as well as non-Jews from Alexandria, or from Egypt, came to deal with this problem. And it seems that the blame was placed on the Alexandrians. One of the Alexandrians was put to death as a ringleader. Lupus, the governor, is named in the allegation in this court trial. And how Scherer reads this is, it seems as a, and this is how Rav Isaac Halevi reads these fragments together with all this information that we've read, is that eventually when Hadrian came to the throne, he wanted to set things right, and therefore opened up the case and prosecuted those who were responsible for this mass, and it'd be similar like the Nuremberg trials after World War II. He viewed it, Hadrian, as really as a Holocaust, and attempted to bring those who were responsible to trial. It's interesting, that is the story we have of Alexandria, but it didn't stop there. It seems that the Jews in Cyrene, this is in Libya, as well as the Jews in Cyprus, were forced to fight with their non-Jewish neighbors. And here we have on page 3, in the third line here, but the Jews of Cyrene, being deprived of their assistance, this is the Greeks' version, after laying waste the country of Egypt, also proceeded to destroy its districts under their leader Lucuas. Against these the emperor sent Marcius Turbo, the emperor being Trajan, who was this great lover of the Jews, with foot and naval forces besides cavalry. He, however, protracting the war a long time against them in many battles, slew many thousands of Jews, not only of Cyrene, but also of Egypt, that had joined them together with their leader Lucuas. So here he describes, again, this is the Greek version of that the Jews had were waging war. And again, in all probability, again, that they were defending themselves. What's in the turn to, and we go down to paragraph D on page 3. Just amazing to read. Again, this is an account by the pagan historian Dio Cassius, who lived not much after these, and lived 100 years after these events. And he describes the Greek version of what had occurred. This is in paragraph D. Meanwhile, this is 116, the Jews in the region of Cyrene had put a certain Andreas, and this was a different, the version of Eusebius is Lucuas, and this is Andreas at their head, were destroying both the Romans and the Greeks. They would cook their flesh, make belts for themselves of their entrails, anoint themselves with their blood, and wear their skins for clothing. Many they sawed in two from the head downwards. Others they would give to wild beasts and force still others to fight as gladiators. I mean, this is just amazing. I mean, the probability of this being true is... But this is the version of the enemies, because this was the justification for them to do what we're going to read further on. In all, consequently, 220,000 perished. Notice they killed 220,000. Even if the number is an exaggeration, we have a sense that the Jews were fighting against a considerable force. In Egypt also they performed many similar deeds, and in Cyprus under the leadership of Artemio. There likewise, 240,000 perished. Amazing that the numbers. For this reason, no Jew may set foot in that land, but even if one of them is driven upon the island by force of the wind, he is put to death. Various persons took part in subduing these Jews, one being Lucius. And this Lucius is further on. His name is Lucius Quitius, or Quitius, who was sent by Trajan. But what we're reading here is really the Greek version. I haven't read the material. It would be nice, it would be just very interesting to read the Arab version of the 67 war. Fascinating reading, probably. But very much unlike what the Israeli version would be. This is the Greek version. It's a what had happened, of course, was that all of the Jews in Cyrene as well as Cyprus were killed out. They evidently put up a stiff resistance, but they were all killed out. If we read on the bottom of page 5 again, is the last line. In the year 121, Hadrian sent colonies to Libya, which had been laid waste by the Jews. In other words, he had to repopulate that whole area because the fighting had been so severe. Again, for your own reading, time doesn't allow to quote from all of these sources. It was worthwhile to read something again which we've quoted in previous class on page 4 and 5 about a similar incident that occurred in Alexandria during the period right before the destruction of the temple in the year 66. And again, just on page 5, this is what happened in the year 66, which is some 60 years, 50 years before this event. Yeah, this is about the Romans. These soldiers rushed violently into that part of the city which was called Delta, where the Jewish people lived together, and did as they were bidden. This is the Romans, though not without bloodshed on their own side, For the Jews got together and said those that were the best armed among them in the forefront and made resistance for a great while. But when once they gave back, they were destroyed unmercifully. And this, their destruction was complete, some being caught in the open field, others forced into their houses, which houses were first plundered of what was in them, then set on fire by the Romans. Wherein no mercy was shown of the infants, no regard had to the aged, but they went on in the slaughter of persons of every age, till all the place was overflowed with blood, and 50,000 of them lay dead upon heaps. Nor had the remainder been preserved, had they not been taken themselves to supplication. This gives just a sense of the history that repeated itself with greater tragedy in the year 116, 117. It's important to understand these events now when we're going to deal with the period of Bar Kokhba and the Emperor Hadrian. In the year 118, Hadrian assumed the throne. And we see on the bottom of page 5, at least the first sentence, it seems that he wanted to somehow do justice to the Jews. And that's why he demanded that area, the former area where the Jews had lived, which had been destroyed by the Greeks, be rebuilt at their own expense. In other words, he had to tax them heavily in order to have this place rebuilt. This seems that he made another gesture to the Jewish community at the beginning of his reign. And that which we read on page 6. There's a fascinating incident. The beginning of Hadrian. Hadrian allowed the temple, issued a decree that the temple be rebuilt. He wanted to restore the rightful place of the Jews. Two great communal figures, Poppas and Lullianus. Poppas and Lullianus, by the way, were two communal leaders that were sentenced to death by this Quintius Lucius. And there was this Roman general that had been appointed by Trajan to suppress these revolts, and who eventually became the governor of Judea, this Lucius Quintius. When Hadrian came to the throne, he had him, this Lucius Quintius, killed. And this Poppas and Lullianus that were scheduled to be killed by this Quintius, Lucius Quintius, got a new lease on life, so to speak. And if their enemy was killed, they were freed. And they now became the leadership in the rebuilding of the temple. And they had a whole, and we said Poppas and Lullianus set up a system of offices from Acco to Antioch to provide gold, silver, and all other needs to all those who were coming in from diaspora to rebuild the temple. In other words, that they gave them all their needs, you know, those who volunteered, and they were collecting from them to allow them to be involved in this project. So it was a whole project. And Jews started streaming into Israel to rebuild the temple. The Samaritans, however, Rav Isaac HaLevi contends that even though this is the reading of the Medrash, and it takes the form of the Midrashic form, the Samaritans here really refer to the Greeks, as these are the enemies of the Jews. Went to the emperor and told him, the emperor should be aware that this city, Yerushalayim, and again, this is just a repetition of what the Medrash is quoting of the claim the Samaritans made against the Jews when the Persians wanted to rebuild the temple. rebuilt, the walls finished, neither property taxes, head taxes, nor tithe taxes of produce will ever be paid. In other words, they prevailed. The enemies of the Jews that we see that were so powerful, that had killed so many Jews, were afraid that the Jews now, if they would have the power, would be a force to contend with. And even though Hadrian originally wanted to do good to the Jews, evidently his advisors prevailed and told him to stop. But he hasn't. What can I do? How could I lose faith? Face. In other words, I just promised that the temple would be built. I mean, how could I renege? So his advisor told to send him the following message. Either change the place of the temple and keep the original dimensions, or make the following change, increase it by 5 cubits, reduce it by 5 cubits, so that the new structure will be different from the original. And so technically he didn't go against his original decree, but now he made it impossible for the Jews to rebuild the temple, because the temple has a specific location as well as the specific dimensions, and they had no way could change it one way or another. So they were stuck. So basically he had annulled this. In other words, and all the people that had streamed in and had suffered all these indignities before. In other words, you have to realize the Jews of North Africa were destroyed. Jews in Cyprus were destroyed. The sources describe slaughtering in Babylon. And the Jews were totally demoralized. And now they have this hope that the Beis HaMikdash shall be rebuilt. And it was shattered. There was a communal meeting regarding the building of the temple that was being held in the valley of Beis Rimon. When the official correspondence came regarding the emperor's decision, they started to cry. At that point, there was a group that was planning to revolt against the government. And they couldn't stop them. So some of the leadership then made the suggestion, said we should bring in some wise individual to quiet down the crowd. So another group said, let's bring Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah, this is the famous sage, because he's the dean of the yeshiva, he's the Rosh Yeshiva, will know how to effectively deal with them. And he's a person who commands respect, and he has the wisdom to deal with the present situation. He, Rabbi Yeshua, came up and delivered the following discourse, and this is a classic. Once the lion, this is like an Aesop's fable, huh? Once the lion, after eating his prey, got a bone stuck in his throat. Unable to remove it himself, he promised the other animals that the one who removes the bone will be rewarded. And everyone was afraid to put their head in the lion's mouth. Whereupon an Egyptian stork stuck its long beak into the lion's mouth and extracted the bone. So the stork went in and put its beak in. The stork then asked the lion for its reward. The lion replied, your reward is that now you'll be able to tell everyone that you put your head in a lion's mouth and you came out in one piece. Because that's your reward. You can tell over the story. Because that's the little fable. Continued Rabbi Yeshua, is enough for us to have come into the mouth of this nation, Rome, to have gone out in peace. Now, consider yourselves that all they've done is just issued a decree and they didn't come out with their legions. It seems that this incident is alluded to, on the bottom of page 5, here, on the second sentence here, in section A. Hadrian overcomes the Jews who are rebelling against the Romans a second time. This is a very curt kind of thing. Dio Cassius, the pagan historian, records no such rebellion. There's no place that's given for this. It's just a very cryptic statement. Rav Isaac HaLevi contends this is perhaps, again, the Greek version of the commotion that arose here at the terrible disappointment that Hadrian had shattered their dreams. And perhaps this minor commotion is considered in yeshivas that, again, it's a second rebellion. Because everything the Jews do, nothing that they do is ever justified, of course. So again, let's just put this all in its setting here. We had tremendous animosity of the non-Jews, of the Greek-speaking non-Jews, to the Jews, to the extent that they, together with the Romans, destroyed Egyptian Jewry, well over a million Jews. This is North Africa. This is the Syrian, Libyan Jewry, Cyprus Jewry. It seems that there was a slaughter in Babylon. The Jews who had their hope that the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt found again that the enemies of the Jews had prevailed against Hadrian and had their hopes slaughtered. And this whole mood now, we need to understand the mood of the Jews, is how they received the next blow. And here on the beginning of page 7 here, Dio Cassius records the following statement. At Jerusalem, he founded a city in place of the one which had been razed to the ground, naming it Aelia Capitolina. And on the site of the temple of God, he raised a new temple to the Roman deity. This brought on a war of no slight importance nor brief duration, for the Jews deemed it intolerable that foreign races should be settled in their city and foreign religious rites planted there. We're going to touch upon this soon. It seems that the next step was that he decreed not only the temple not be rebuilt, but in order to quash the Jewish their feelings of independence, that he had to take away Jerusalem from them totally. And basically, what he was making a pagan city. Aelia is the name of his family. Capitolina is an allusion to the Capitol, the hill in Rome, which had the temple for the chief Roman deity. And here there would be a pagan temple, and it would become Jerusalem, then would be a pagan city. And according to Dio Cassius, this is deemed to be the justification, what caused them to revolt. Again, in the light of everything, it carries with it much greater import. However, there is another reason which is given for the revolt. Here we have on page 7 in section 3 that Hadrian was not satisfied with just denying the Jews to build a temple, or to replace that Jerusalem to make it a pagan city, but wanted to destroy Judaism itself. Because the reason a war broke out with Judea was because a prohibition about circumcision was made. This was Spartianus was the official biographer of Hadrian, and describing the revolt, describes it as a revolt for religious independence. Rav Isaac Halevi claims that it really included more, this original decree, more than just circumcision. We find at a later date there was an annulment of the Roman decree, which had three parts in it. One was circumcision. One was Shabbos. The Jews were not allowed to observe Shabbos. And one was the laws of marital purity of going to the mikveh. Even though this was a decree that was annulled much later, Rav Isaac Halevi theorizes, though, this was the original Hadrianic decree that was never officially annulled, but was just not observed. In other words, after Hadrian's death and new emperor came, they just did not enforce the law that was on the books. It was only later on that it was totally it was totally annulled. We have another incident with this period, dealing with Rabbi Akiva, who lived during the period, and described a situation where they were not allowed to say Shema. And when they did it, that they had to be, they recited it very, as we see them here in paragraph C. The Rav Meir said, once we were sitting before Rabbi Akiva in the base medrash, they at this point did not disallow them from studying. But we were reciting the Shema, but we didn't recite it loud enough for our ears to hear because of a Roman officer that was standing by the doorway. Reason. A second reason. They basically wanted to destroy Judaism. So in a sense, we had the horrors of Trajan, but it was at least aimed at Jews. Here Hadrian wanted to destroy Judaism itself. And now we have, listen, these two reasons coming together, and this ferment and the sense that they found living under the Romans totally intolerable. Dio Cassius describes, though, the beginnings of the revolt here. In the year 122, here it is again, Hadrian took the throne in the year 118, shortly after, as he gave the permission for the Jews to rebuild the temple, he took back that permission. On reaching Greece, he became a spectator at the mysteries. This is evidently the pagan cult. It's a prophetic pagan cult of the Eleusinian cult in Greece. After this, he passed through Judea into Egypt and offered sacrifice to Pompey. As he went to Pompey's grave, Pompey was the great Roman general. He was, if you recall, he was a member of the triumvirate. It was with Julius Caesar and Crassus. He was the conqueror of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was first conquered by the Romans in the year 63 before the Common Era by Pompey. It's very telling, now he went to his grave to pray. First he went to Greece, went through Judea, and then went to Egypt to pray at Pompey's grave. And he continues on page 8, at Jerusalem he founded a city in place of the one which had been razed to the ground, namely Aelia Capitolina, which we've read the citation. And it seems that he had first made, as we read, he had made this decree to change the city after he'd been in Greece, right, before he went down to Egypt. Because he said that the Jews found it intolerable, but so long indeed as Hadrian was close by in Egypt, in other words, and again in Syria, they remained quiet. So evidently he had made the decree. He went to pray by Pompey's grave, which Rav Isaac HaLevi theorizes, and basically he basically wanted to defeat the Jews. He came to the grave of the man who had first conquered Jerusalem and defeated them. He was making a new step. His predecessors had defeated the Jews. They had destroyed the temple, but they never built a pagan temple in its place. And he felt that he needed help from the gods. And perhaps it fits in why he had come before in Egypt, in Greece, felt that he had the gods on his side. He was ready to do war with the Jews. Went to Jerusalem, says, made the decree that Jerusalem should cease being the symbol of Judaism, but rather would become the symbol of the Roman religion. And it's not clear at this point, and perhaps, again, we have no, from Dio, we have no hint, But it's quite possible that at this point the decrees began as well to squash the practice of Judaism. He went to Egypt, and again he went to Syria. Evidently he didn't travel home immediately, but he was in Egypt for some time, went to Syria. And during this time, and it's not saying how long this took, the Jews remained quiet. However, they were preparing for war. They purposely made of poor quality such weapons they were called upon to furnish. In other words, the Jews were actually requisitioned, and they were forced to produce armaments for the Roman legion. They purposely produced inferior armaments that would be rejected by the Romans. And therefore, they had access to these rejects. Themselves made thus the use of them, and when he went farther away, they openly revolted. And it would seem from reading this that the revolt began, at least the beginnings of the revolt, shortly after the year 122. We have another quotation, which again would seem to place the year 122. The Medrash Eicha, as well as the Yerushalmi and Tain, the fourth chapter of Tainus, says 52 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, Betar began to be destroyed. I mean, it was made. But here it's clearly from other citations, Betar was a city that was standing during the time of the destruction of the temple. It was before. Made was not that it was built, but actually it was the campaign began against it. Because here, the seeds were sown for its eventual destruction. So first the Jews gained armaments. Inferior armaments, but they gained armaments. The next, as Dio continues on in paragraph C, to be sure they did not dare try conclusions with the Romans in the open field. Again, they were prepared. They knew they couldn't at this. They weren't ready to fight the Romans. They occupied the advantageous positions in the country and strengthened them with mines and walls, or they may have places of refuge whenever they should be hard pressed and might meet together unobserved underground. And they pierced the subterranean passage from above at intervals to let in air and light. Dr. David Weingarten told me he came back from a trip from Israel, found in the Judean hills. Archaeologists found whole caverns built into these hills with just a narrow opening on the top. And they theorize that they originally had different theories of what their purpose, these are these caverns that were they're referred to in Dio Cassius. At first, the Romans took no account of them. Again, we don't have a sense of a timeline here of how long this burgeoning resistance movement, took place to gain steam. Soon, however, all Judea had been stirred up, and the Jews everywhere were showing signs of disturbance. Gathering together and giving evidence of great hostility to the Romans, partly by secret and partly by overt acts. Many outside nations, too, were joining them through eagerness for gain. Again, this is Dio Cassius' version. And the whole earth, one might almost say, was being stirred up over the matter. So here we have a sense of the Jews had really had, to coin the phrase, enough is enough, we want Mashiach now. Things had just gotten too far. We have in the bottom of page 8 an interesting quote, though, and a different look of the events. For a passage in the Gemara in Gittin, in Nun Zion, this is Nun Hamad Beis, and this is Nun Zion Amud Aleph. in 57a. Through the shaft of a litter, Betar was destroyed. It was the custom when a boy was born to plant a cedar tree. When a girl was born to plant a cedar tree, a pine was born. The custom was when the boy was born, you planted a cedar tree. When the girl was born, you planted a pine tree. And that was the custom. And when they married, the tree was cut down and a canopy made of the branches. One day, the daughter of the emperor was passing when the shaft of her litter broke. So they lopped some branches off a cedar tree and brought it to her. In other words, she doesn't know about this thing. The litter over here means a carriage. And her carriage was, you know, and she needed something for an axle. The Jews thereupon fell upon them and beat them,
because they had thought that the Romans had purposely violated their sacred custom.
They reported to the emperor the Jews were rebelling, and he marched against them. Again, this is a passage from the Agadata, of course. This is a Medrash. We don't have dates here. We don't have an exact setting. But it would seem but Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, preserve this story. And perhaps what it's telling us is another side of this story. It's not clear what year the daughter of the emperor was passing by. But in all likelihood, it could be when Hadrian himself was visiting in the year 122. We had originally stated why Trajan had such bad feelings against the Jews. And that was the story when a child was born, they fasted, and when a child died, they lit lights. We have no inkling, though, of why Hadrian had such terrible feelings towards the Jews. But here, perhaps in this little story, it encapsulates that perhaps this little minor incident was the thing that started off this whole chain of events. That the people felt that they had that they were capable of taking on the Romans, didn't have the foresight, and this is what the Talmud brings this passage. It says, Ashiyodim Mefachet Tomid, in other words, that happy is the person who's always in fear, who's always in trepidation, always examining what he's doing to see what the ramifications are going to be. The Jews did not have that presence of mind, reacted and attacked the emperor's daughter. Well, how was the emperor supposed to feel after this incident? And perhaps this is the thing that convinced him that the Jews are incorrigible, and the only way to deal with the Jews is totally to stamp on them. And perhaps this is the incident that triggered his decision to make Jerusalem a pagan city, to outlaw circumcision, to outlaw the practice of Judaism. This little act, which would be a minor act, which is not recorded by historians because it's so minor, really set the stage for all the terrible events that occurred subsequently. And in just recording this incident, Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, were pleading with the people, were teaching them the importance of forethought. But it's perhaps this incident, perhaps more than any one, and this is what was preserved. In other words, the fact is that they wanted to make Jerusalem a pagan city was preserved by pagan historians, not by Jews. The decrees are preserved in passing, so to speak. They're not the only thing of historical import that's recorded regarding Betar is this minor incident of them taking down this tree. And yet Chazal looked at that as really the central issue. In other words, basically look before you leap. And it's really this impetuousness that eventually led to this chain of events that destroyed everything. And in the midst of all of this rose a leader. In other words, the Jews had already started this rebellion and planned for it. It's not clear at what point this leader took hold of the movement. Was it early on? Was it only later? We have no details. And his name was Bar, as is described in the Talmud's Bar Koziva. And we turn to page 9. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Akiva. Hoya Dairish, this is Rabbi Akiva, would be held the Bar Kochva, as Ben Koziva. And he said, there's a prophecy in the which is recorded in the book of Numbers by Bilam. This is in Parshas Bullock. This is by the non-Jewish prophet Bilam, looking at Jewish history in the future. He says, Dorach Koichov Miyakov, a star will trample over, this is from Jacob, will shoot out, will trample their enemies. Rabbi Akiva felt that it refers, this person that's prophesied by Bilam, this Kochav, is referring to this Ben Koziva. Al Tikre Kochav, don't read it Kochav, Ela Kosev. And there's a similar of the Kof and the Beis. It's an allusion to this Ben Koziva. Rabbi Akiva Kadav Ichomila Lahadein Bar Koziva, when he saw Bar Koziva, he would say, Hainu Malko Mashiach. This is the Mashiach. Rabbi Akiva's opinion was not universally accepted, though. Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta, Akiva, Yalud Asovim Belochayayach, grass will grow from your cheeks. In other words, you'll be long dead, and grass will be growing. Vadayan Einabo, he wouldn't have come yet. This is not Mashiach. From this passage, we don't see what the rationale of Rabbi Akiva's opponents were. It just says clearly that they just opposed his judgment. Historically, he is known as Bar Kochva. The Talmud never calls him Bar Kochva, just Ben Koziva, and we have the passage where Rabbi Akiva alluded, made this allusion through the verse. But the name, whenever they refer to him by name, it's Ben Koziva. Oh, we'll touch upon this. But we, from Eusebius, from the church historian, we have the name Bar Kochva. And this is the, page 9, paragraph B. The rebellion of the Jews once more progressed in character and extent, and Rufus, this is Tinius Rufus, the governor of Judea, when military had been sent him by the emperor, moved out against them, treating their madness without mercy. He destroyed in heaps thousands of men, women, and children, and under the law of war enslaved their land. The Jews were at the time led by a certain Bar Kochebes, which means star, a man who was murderous and a bandit, but relied on his name as if dealing with slaves, and claimed to be a luminary who had come down to them from heaven, was magically enlightening those who were in misery. This is the church's version of the story. Bar Kochva, though, is not mentioned by Dio Cassius. It's only mentioned by Eusebius. We find that Rabbi Akiva claimed that he was Mashiach. It seems from Eusebius himself, from Eusebius' version, that Bar Kochva made some sort of divine claim. We have a further citation here, which seems to bear out the fact that not only Rabbi Akiva claimed that he was Mashiach, but he himself saw himself as Mashiach. And it says he shall make a quick understanding. It says that the Verichu Biyiras Hashem, he should smell, and he has an understanding of the fear of the Lord. And this, it really, it means that he has a psychic ability. And this is the poet referring to Mashiach. He can smell people. He has a psychic ability through the fear of God. Because he's such a person who fears God, he was given this psychic ability. Rav Alexandri says, he brings down this in the beginning of the pasuk says v'hiricho. He interprets v'hiricho not smelling, but from the word rechayim, which is a millstone. Teach that he's loaded with good deeds and suffering as a mill is laden. In other words, the mill is all this grain to be processed. Says that the Moshiach will have good deeds but will suffer. Rava reads it, as we originally interpreted, he smells a man and judges. Notice he has a psychic ability. It's written, and he now judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. Yet with righteousness shall he judge the poor. Bar Koziva reigned 2.5 years and said to the rabbis, I am the Moshiach. I am the Messiah. So here it clearly has that he claimed himself to be Mashiach. The answer of Messiah is written that he smells and judges. Let's see whether he can do so. When they saw he was unable to judge by the scent, they slew him. If we take this version literally, it means that they saw he was not Mashiach, he was an imposter, and he endangered the Jewish community. Because the Jewish were willing to risk their lives because they felt that they would win. This version had that they slew him. Other versions were going to read that he was killed fighting the Romans. The Abarbanel offers the interpretation that not that it's taken literally that they slew him, but they were not in power to kill him at the time. But what they did was that they wished him bad. In other words, they gave him not their blessings, but their curse, and it ended up that he died. Yeah, Mark? So, from the sources we have, here we find a rebellion began. A leader rose who claimed to be Mashiach. How successful was he in his victory? One thing is we know that he minted coins. And there's a coin which is called, this is we found in paragraph D on page 9. This is referring to the redemption of Meister Shane of the second tithe. Can be made by means of coin which has no currency. And as they're referring to the old coins that no longer of a government that no longer is functioning. As for instance, one possessed Koziva coins of Jerusalem, which seems to indicate that they're coins of Jerusalem. There's a on page 10. Find what the rabbis wanted to. Store away every Hadrianic and Trajanic, or this is to read together. His name was Hadrian Trajanus, so perhaps it's read together. Denarius, which had become worn in use. This is a question how to read this thing, because it was coined from metal captured from Jerusalem. There is a question how to read this passage. There are those who maintain, we know that in order to get currency, Ben Koziva did not have coins and have the metal immediately. He took the old coins, which were from Trajan and Hadrian, and re-minted them. And on some of the coins, we can discern the old minting. And according to this, it would mean that those coins that had been re-minted, the rabbis wanted to hold in storage because they had been used now for collection for the temple treasury. There's another interpretation is that we also know that when Hadrian was victorious, he again took Bar Kozeva's coins and reminted them to put Hadrian's face on them. So which minting they're referring to. But it seems to allude that there were coins that were collected for building the temple. In Jewish sources, we have no reference that he actually did build a temple. And in terms of, it could be because of the fighting and the situation, even building was just impossible in any case. But we do have an allusion that coins seems to have been collected for that purpose. The last coins that we have, which have still the remnants of Hadrian on it, are from the year 131-132. When he finally became king of Israel, that was in those years. The Bar Kokhba revolt was squashed in the year 134-135. The Bar Kokhba. So here, when he finally, we only have coins from year 1 and year 2. I don't know if we have coins from year 3. They have stamped year 3. His whole reign was only some 2-3 years. Evidently, it seems he reigned after this prolonged revolt. It's a situation where they felt that they had ridded the Jerusalem of Romans. One of the coins here on Rambam has the name Shimon, because his name was Shimon Bar Kozeva. Bar Kokhba's name was Shimon. His first name was Simon. Shimon Bar Kozeva. The second thing, you notice that it has the top has the facade of the temple, which some observe that even if he didn't build the temple, but he had, it would seem his design was to create, and if he was Mashiach, so he was going to rebuild the temple. And we have the name Yerushalayim on the coins. We have the name Shimon on the coins. There's also a reference, this is Elozer HaKohen, it would seem that he pointed a high priest. And he readied himself, if he'd not actually made the temple, but readied himself for the eventuality. The third one has, he's called Shimon Nosi Yisroel. He calls himself Nosi, which is also a name for king, president, king. In a canyon, not far from the Dead Sea, called Nachal Chever, was found a whole group of letters written by Bar Kokhba himself to his commanders in the field. This was the commanders in Ein Gedi, which is the oasis in the north part near the Dead Sea. Here we have, if you're on the bottom page 10, and Shimon Bar Kozeva. His name in all the letters is not Kozeva with a Zion, but rather Kozeva with a Samach, which tends to support the theory that his name, the Bar Kozeva, is really not his name, but it was changed. Because after the defeat, the word Kozev means disappointment or deceitful. Kol Odom Kozev. Yamarti Bechovzi Kol Odom Kozev. He was given that name. He was really Bar Kozeva, and it's changed to Bar Kozeva. Later writers. His original name is Bar Kozeva. And here again, he is writing to his commanders in the field, evidently to search and seize the wheat of this person, Chonon, the son of Yishmol, who evidently does not want to follow his dictates and to cooperate. He refers to the people of Tekoa. If you find them, says they will be the houses will be burned. Says like this. Because if you house, even he speaks very roughly to these people, if you hold any of these people who are shirking their duty, you will be punished. On page 11, we have again and again, these are orders to a military commander. My orders, you will send to me a loza barchita before Shabbos. The wheat and fruit should be confiscated. If anyone opposes you, send him to me and I shall punish him. Seems a scribe. The next one. This following one is a fascinating one. Shimon, again, he's writing first person. The word is Shimon to Yehuda bar Menashe and Kiryas Arba, Arabia. I've sent you two donkeys. You shall send them two men to Yonasan bar Bayan and Masabala. These are the two people who were the commanders in Ein Gedi. In order that you shall pack and send to the camp towards you Pombra, Lulavim, Citron, Zesrogim, and you from your place send others who will bring myrtles and willows. In other words, send them back to me. It's Sukkot time now, and we need the Arba Minim, we need the four varieties to take for the mitzvah. In this last, this is a fragment, though, I mean, of a document. On the 20th of Shavat, year 2 of the liberation of Israel by Shimon ben Kosiba, president of Israel. And again, he describes the lands which are royal lands, which are leased from Shimon ben Kosiba. We know that the Romans had titles to land that they leased out as royal lands. This was just like we have national lands. We have our national parks. We have national grazing lands. There was national land that was leased out by the Romans. When he was victorious, he took it over and now became governmental lands of his. And he leased out those lands. The Diocasius continues, then indeed Hadrian sent against them his best generals. First of these was Julius Severus, who was dispatched from Britain, where he was governor against the Jews. Severus did not venture to attack his opponents in the open at any point, in view of their numbers and their desperation. But by intercepting small groups, thanks to the number of his soldiers and his under-officers, by depriving them of food and shutting them up, he was able rather slowly to be sure, both compare little danger, to crush, exhaust, and exterminate them. Very few of them, in fact, survived. 50 of their most important outposts and 985 of their most famous villages were razed to the ground. 580,000 men were slain in various raids and battles. The number of those that perished by famine, disease, and fire was past finding out. Thus nearly the whole of Judea was made desolate, a result of which the people had forewarning before the war. For the tomb of Solomon, which the Jews regarded as an object of veneration, fell to pieces of itself, collapsed, and many wolves, hyenas rushed howling into their cities. Many Romans, moreover, perished in this war. It took a tremendous toll of the Romans. Therefore, Hadrian, in writing to the Senate, did not employ the opening phrase commonly affected by the emperors, if you and your children are in health, it is well, I and the legions are in health. He did not use that opening phrase. He was not in health. They had won the victory, but at a tremendous cost. Eusebius, on page 12, we have the reaches height in the 18th year of the reign of Hadrian in Beth Thera. The Medrash calls it the Beis Tor, the Talmud Bavli calls it Beitar, which was a strong citadel not very far from Jerusalem. There's actually an Arab village in the northwest of Jerusalem called Beitera, which is Bitar, which is assumed to be the ruins nearby, is assumed to be the site of Beitar. The siege lasted a long time before the rebels were driven to final destruction by famine, thirst. The instigator of their madness paid the penalty he deserved. Here we've gone through the beginnings of the revolt, set the stage, so to speak, with the rebellion, the crushing of the Jews in North Africa and Cyprus, the outlawing of the practice of Judaism, creating Jerusalem into a pagan city. We started with the Bar Kozeva or Bar Kosiba becomes the leader, as we see in the tone, he acts as a very, very authoritarian leader. He mints coins with his name. He is identified by some as Moshiach. It seems he identified himself as Moshiach. How many people, let's say the authorities of Jewry, went along with Rabbi Akiva's assessment that Ben Kozeva was Moshiach? We don't have any hard and fast numbers. The Medrash that we stated only had two people, Rabbi Akiva on one side, Yochanan and Torta on the other. One would assume, though, that if Rabbi Akiva held him to be Moshiach, Rabbi Akiva's disciples probably held him in the same opinion. We do know, though, and there's a message from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Yudzayin Amud Beis, of a Sanhedrin has to have the ability to have some of the members speak different languages in order to be able to communicate and to deal with cases of people throughout the Jewish world. Yavna, the Sanhedrin in Yavna had four. In Beitar, that Sanhedrin had three. A Sanhedrin that needs to speak in all these languages is a central court, which Jews from all over send their problems. A local court has no use for knowing all the languages because they only deal with people and they're familiar with people in the local dialect. Evidently, Beitar was a central court and had at least three rabbis that were linguists. It seems, if Beitar being the capital city of Shimon ben Kosiba, it would seem that those members of the Sanhedrin were inclined, it would just speculate, were inclined to follow him. If those who were determined that he was not Mashiach, they would probably have nothing to do with the man. So if he has a whole Sanhedrin, evidently we're dealing with leading scholars. So he had a group of leading scholars with him. It's not clear if Rabbi Akiva himself was ever in Beitar, ever. I mean, we have no, evidently he wasn't there when it was destroyed. But we do have an inkling that it seems that he did have a group of scholars that were with him. On page 13, we have the version of how it came out that he finally fell. For 3.5 years, the Emperor Hadrian surrounded Beitar. This is the version we have in the Medrash. Rabbi Lozer says of Modin, who was one of the great scholars of the period, was a relative, seems to have been an uncle of Bar Kochba's. He was with him. And during the time of the siege, he wore sackcloth and fasted, and he prayed daily. The enemies suspected the secret of Bar Kochba's survival of the siege was the righteousness of Elazar Hamadoi. They arranged a frame-up, so to speak, that someone came. They have a Kuthian, whispered while Elazar Hamadoi was davening, whispered in his ear and made it as if that he was he was exchanging state secrets. They grabbed the Kuthian and asked him what he had said. He said that he, in any case, he felt if he told them or not, he would be killed. It's state secrets. He doesn't want to divulge it. Evidently, he had intimated that he was plotting with this Elazar Hamadoi against Bar Kochba. Bar Kochba realized the scene, asked his uncle, Elazar Hamadoi, what did he tell you? Elazar Hamadoi was davening. He was oblivious to the whole scene. He didn't realize what had happened. When he was questioned by Bar Kochba, he denied the whole incident. He said, I didn't do anything. I didn't hear anything. He became so enraged, Bar Kochba hit him slammed to the ground and he died. Felt that he had, at that point, he had lost all, the, when Ben-Koziva, Bar-Kokhba, had lost his self-control, he had caused his death. He was no longer worthy for any divine protection. Not long afterwards, they succeeded in the Romans succeeded in capturing Betar, and Bar Kokhba was killed. The Medrash does bring, though, that he was not killed by the swords of the Romans, but actually he was killed. He was bitten by a snake in the middle of battle. And Hadrian saw it as a divine omen that he had actually been killed by God himself. The massacre by Betar was so immense, in the bottom of page 14, it says they slew the inhabitants until the horses waded in blood up to the nostrils. The blood rolled along stones the size of 40 saw and flowed into the sea. Those that were killed were not allowed the decency of a burial. And in fact, it was 3 years, as 3 years later, when a new emperor arose, Antoninus Pius, that they were allowed to bury their dead. It describes, in the bottom of page 14, Hadrian possessed a large vineyard 18 miles square, as far as from Tiberias to Sepphoris, and they surrounded with a fence consisting of the slain at Betar. In other words, they put the people row after row for miles around. They just lined them up and they used that as a fence around his property. It happened that the day that it fell was Tisha B'Av. After the fall, Hadrian went on with his plans, and Jerusalem was finally converted into a pagan city, Aelia Capitolina, and they did build a temple on the site of the Beis HaMikdash. They built a temple to the pagan deity. And they created a decree that no Jew then was allowed to enter Jerusalem. Just as a final note here, on the bottom we have Hadrian. This is again from Eusebius. In the year, this is 136, Aelia was founded by Aelius Hadrianus. Before its gate, that of the road by which we go to Bethlehem, he set up an idol of a pig in marble, signifying the subjugation of the Jews to Roman authority. Why did this occur? What did the Jews do to deserve this kind of punishment? The Medrash in Shir HaShirim explains that God administered four oaths corresponding to the four generations that pressed for a premature termination of the Gullus. There's an allusion of four oaths that he swore the Benois Yerushalayim, the daughters of Jerusalem. This is the woman who's speaking to them to find the lover, to find, which is the allegory of the Jewish people to God. And there's this oath. The oath, according to the Medrash, refers that don't push the Golus. Don't make a premature ending. It's a punishment accepted as such. Except for the fact you're chastised, the only way you'll leave Golus is to become tzaddikim, to undo the wrongs that created it. And this was basically the last chapter of the destruction of the temple. And its aftermath, it became now a pagan city. And the site has either become been a, through different successfully in succession, was a pagan temple, then was a church, and then was a mosque, which is on its site today. In the next class, in 2 weeks, we will be dealing with the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the death of Rabbi Akiva, and subsequently in the death of the other Torah scholars of the generation. I'd like to, we're running late, I'd like to stop now, just to leave, you know, to leave it open now for questions. Yeah, I was waiting. Right. I was waiting for that question. In questions like this, there's so much we know and so much we can theorize about. What's interesting to note is the Rambam's, Maimonides' approach to the problem.
I told you I was prepared.
We won't go through the whole thing here. The Rambam, let me just read for you the Rambam. Here, I won't read the Hebrew, I'll translate it. You shouldn't think that the king, the Mashiach, has to make miracles, has to make anything new in the world to resurrect the dead, or anything similar. It is not so. Because Rabbi Akiva, who is a great scholar amongst the scholars, the authors of the Mishnah, he was the arms bearer of Ben Koziva, the king. The Kesef Mishnah knows that we don't have any medrash to the extent that he did anything. All our sources are that just Rabbi Akiva made a statement. Here he has that he did more, it seems, than made a statement. But we don't have the source that the Rambam is relying upon. We don't have that source. Until the extent that Ben Koziv was killed due to his sins. Since he was killed, then it was known that he was not the Mashiach. But don't ask from the Mashiach any kind of supernatural sign. He says, Im Yamad Melech Mebeis Dov, a king arises from the house of David, who's involved in learning Torah and doing mitzvahs like David, his forefather, according to the Torah, the written and the oral Torah. And he will force all of Jewry to go on that path and to strengthen the breaches. And he will fight the wars of God. The wars over here were meaning like Bar Kokhba, in other words, not... He is Becheska Shumet. He is tentatively the Mashiach. If he's successful and rebuilds the temple and brings back all the dispersed of Israel, then we know certainly he is the Mashiach. And he will go on to rectify the world that they should all together serve God. This is, I've left off with people, but this is what he's saying. The Rambam's approach is that Rabbi Akiva was not in error. Rabbi Akiva basically followed all the steps. Two witnesses come to you in a court, you're a judge, two witnesses come to you in a courtroom, and they say that they saw O.J. Simpson kill his wife. Believes them, unless they're perjured, right? We have to accept testimony, even though we don't know for sure if they are telling the truth. We don't know. We weren't there. There's a law in the Torah that you accept testimony. There's another law the Rambam brings in the beginning of Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, the fundamental principles of the Torah, that a prophet, someone says, I am a prophet of God, and he performs a miracle, and we know he's a righteous person. We still don't know if he's really a prophet. We only assume he's the prophet. We undergo that assumption, and then we rely on that assumption, that he is a prophet. We'll listen to what he says. If we find that he says something which is not in the parameters of what a prophet is supposed to say, he is not the... we will kill him. If this prophet that we've assumed so far is a prophet, he goes on and says something that they should worship idols, or we don't accept them. Up until now, the time we accept them, because it was the best information was available to us. We don't know the truth, and we're not all psychic. We can only deal with the information at hand. To our best guesstimate, he's telling the truth, we follow it. Two witnesses in a courtroom, if they're valid witnesses, we haven't disqualified them for any other reason. They come to us, they give testimony, we've cross-examined them. The testimony holds up under cross-examination. We accept it. That's what we're bound to do by law. Do we know for sure that it's the truth? No, we don't know. We're not... but we are bound. In a sense, Moshiach has its own, according to the Rambam, has its own test. The test is not infallible, but it's enough to make a tentative conclusion that he is Moshiach. According to the Rambam, at least how he understands Rabbi Kiva, Bar Kochva passed the test. It wasn't that Rabbi Kiva was wrong. In other words, it's just he is as wrong as a judge who accepts the evidence of people who are later on found to be perjurers. But at that point, this is he had followed the process. Rabbi Kiva did not make any mistake in process. He did the best he could under the circumstances. So basically, he vindicates, the Rama vindicates Rabbi Kiva's position. It was rather than that he just erred. He didn't err, and there's no one psychic, and as he had fulfilled all the requirements, at least at that point in the conflict, of what would be expected from Moshiach. The Rambam has it would seem that, you know, that Rabbi Kiva though was not alone in his in his determination. He says, he and the other wise men of the generation. It's not clear that that is true from the sources that we quoted. The only thing close to it, though, is the fact, he says, in Beitar did have a Sanhedrin, and to be a member of the Sanhedrin, one would have to be of the highest caliber. So that perhaps would be the source of the Rambam. But again, the Medrash that we've quoted just has two people, Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta, just... but that is the Rambam's approach to the... Yes? Repeat the first question. Yes.
The first question was whether
there were... Right. Okay. Yeah, the question about the relation of the Sanhedrin of Beitar versus the Sanhedrin of Yavna. Yavna, it seems, because of the Roman oppression, you have to realize that the years of Trajan and afterwards in Hadrian, while they're preparing for the revolt, and they were suppressing Judah, and the Sanhedrin did not sit. Yavne had long ceased to exist as a center of the Sanhedrin. Beitar was a latter-day replacement, so to speak. In terms of the second question about the Regimorid B'Malchus, it seems from the letters that he had, that he wrote, if you look at the citations of the letters, that he demanded allegiance from his subjects as a king would demand from, but not all of them gave him that allegiance. The citation from the Gomorrah in Sanhedrin that has the sages rejecting him because he does not qualify for Mashiach and deemed him that he should be killed evidently felt that if he is truly an imposter, then he has really no right to endanger the Jewish people. Because really, if they are still under Roman rule, and he is not Mashiach, they have no right. In other words, he doesn't have the right to take the liberties of standing up and rebelling against them. He's endangering them. So they looked at him as a menace. And that's what it says, V'kotlu, they killed him. They take literally, or they wished him his death, or they withdrew support. So I guess it would be, you know, dependent if they viewed him as Mashiach. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. What should they have done? In other words, basically. It would seem from this that what they should not have done is rebelled. And what they should have done is either bribe their way, because people were left. Because if you know that it's going to be futile to rebel, and you know that it's what's going to happen is going to be the worst possible ramifications would come out from a rebel. So you just do the best in that situation. Either you bribe your way, try to have it repealed, which they've done countless times, or leave. You know, go to Babylon, which was not under Roman rule at the time. I mean, they'd have to do something. You know, very often with bribery, a local official would not. Just as it happened many times in our Roman officials would not apply the law. They were very corrupt. Okay, one more question. Yes. The Mashiach comes. Right. That's what it seems from the Midrashim. That it's really that Golus is a sentence that you'll get the reprieve when you change behavior. That's basically, it's like someone who's in prison, and he'll be put on probation, whatever he'll be able, if they see that the behavior has improved. Otherwise, he'll still be in those attempts to end Golus quickly ended up with the worst possible way, much worse than if they had just endured the situation as it was. Okay, good luck.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.